So without further ado, let me take a second and talk about Dr. Goldstein and the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. So I'm really excited, Dr. Goldstein, to have you back speaking with us today. Dr. Goldstein has a wonderful reputation in the patient community for being an incredibly compassionate, thoughtful, and thorough mitochondrial disease specialist. And that's a well-deserved, Dr. Goldstein, for the time that you give to your patients and the thoughtful approach that you take with them. But outside of her clinical role, Dr. Goldstein is actually very actively involved in several leadership roles with UMDF and the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, and is really a driving force between making advances in progress in clinical care, in particular for patients with mitochondrial disease. And Dr. Goldstein, I'll let you tell us a little bit more about where you are right now at Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh and NAMDAC and so forth. But today we're going to be talking a little bit about the most recent activities of the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, which include transplantation in mito patients, stroke protocol for MELOS patients, standards of care, and centers of excellence. So we're really excited about that. So Dr. Goldstein, thank you so much for taking your time to be with us today. I'll let you do a little better job maybe introducing yourself and what you're working on, and then we'll just jump right in and we'll follow along on the slides with you.
Okay, thank you so much, Christy, and thank you for giving me this opportunity to give everyone an update. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can hear you great. Thank you.
Great. So I am a child neurologist, and I work at the Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh, and I am the director of neurogenetics here, where I help run several neurogenetics clinics. One of them is mitochondrial disease focused, and one of them is another disorder called neurofibromatosis, but I'm well known in my division for being the neurogenetics person. And I also collaborate very strongly with our genetics division, which is run by Jerry Vockley here in Pittsburgh. And together, we're also involved in the Center for Rare Disease Therapy, which is a new center here at Children's, and one that hopefully will continue to bring clinical trials to patients with rare disease. Currently, we are a NAMDAC site, and Christy, you mentioned NAMDAC. So for people who don't know about NAMDAC, NAMDAC stands for North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, and this is a group of 16 centers in the United States and Canada that are actively enrolling patients for a clinician-entered database, and there are also several natural history studies being done through NAMDAC. In particular, there's a natural history study of Alpers disease, and there's a natural history study of Pearson disease. And we're hoping to add more natural history studies to the NAMDAC Center. This can be found on the NAMDAC webpage. If you just Google NAMDC, it should be the first thing that comes up. And there's a lot of good information about mitochondrial disease, as well as your nearest center. You can be enrolled in NAMDAC only through a participating center, but you can certainly be under the care of another clinician and then just be referred to your local center for the patient registry. In addition, I just want to mention that there are other patient registries currently actively recruiting participants, and the UMDF has recently started a patient registry. And I'm going to talk towards the end of this update about the importance of patient registries, so I want everyone to be aware of those two registries. I also want to talk about some of the other clinical trials that are ongoing, and I think, Christy, you've done a great job making sure our community is updated about the clinical trials. Currently, I am a site for the Reata Pharmaceuticals trial, as well as the Stealth Biopeptides trial, and right now these are both for adults with mitochondrial myopathy. I know that both companies are hopefully going to start looking at trials for the pediatric population, and there are several other drug companies that are also doing trials. Raptor Pharmaceuticals is one of them. I'm not a site for that, but then we have other drug companies that have been approaching us, approaching different centers, holding meetings, trying to figure out what the outcome measures would be, and hopefully designing further trials. So I'm hoping to see another two or three trials coming down and being available for patient recruitment very soon. So I just want to talk a little bit about the Mitochondrial Medicine Society. This has been in existence for over a decade, and was started by physicians at the University of California, San Diego, Bob Navio and Richard Haas. And I think it's grown significantly over the past several years. We now have more of an international membership as well. We redesigned our webpage recently, and we redefined our mission statement, which is advancing education, research, and global collaboration in clinical mitochondrial medicine. We are a group of clinicians who take care of patients with mitochondrial disease, and we have been coming up with projects that we feel are extremely important to our patient community. So I am going to talk about our recent projects. Some of these are either in press or about to be in press, and due to copyright laws, Christy and I will need to check to see which slides can be available permanently on the website. But I will be presenting them today. And again, please just use some restraint in trying to copy those and save those permanently for right now, because they are not yet, some of the data is not yet published. But I was too anxious to be able to share the information with you. I wanted to be able to present it. So I think from that, I will just go into the slides for now. Also, one other thing about our website, I just want to make sure people are aware that it exists. It is www.mitosoc, that's MITOSOC.org, and a very good repository of our published papers and other information. And I would encourage people to go check that out and make sure that your current treating physicians and clinicians are aware of the website.
I would second that and say that if there's anything that you pass on to your primary care doctor and specialists who may not be as familiar with mitochondrial disease, it would be to direct them to that website so that they could become better educated about managing patients with mitochondrial disease.
And on our website, we have a live Google map, and anytime I have a request to add a physician, I add somebody to that map. And so it is right now a worldwide map of doctors and clinicians who have identified themselves as taking care of patients with mitochondrial disease. And again, this is not a centers of excellence yet, but these are physicians that have identified themselves as taking patients. So the link to the Google map is also on our website. So I'm going to start going through our slides. And before I start jumping into the projects, on the second slide, you see the projects that we've been working on recently, and Christy also mentioned them. The first one that I'm going to mention is our solid organ transplantation project, which was spearheaded by Sumit Parikh in Cleveland. And I just want to say a few words about it before we go through the data. He will be presenting the poster this coming week at the Society for Inherited Metabolic Disorders in Florida. And after that, we hope for a publication in a journal. And that is still being submitted and refined. The reason that we did this project, though, is, again, you know, as clinicians, we think very carefully about what are the current issues that are being faced by our patients and what are some of the issues that other physicians ask us about. And transplantation has come up many times for all of us, and so we decided to try to get more information out there about transplantation for mitochondrial disease patients. So I'll go through that data in a minute. Number two is the stroke protocol for MELOS. And there were many papers, especially from the Japanese group, talking about using arginine for acute stroke and MELOS. But it was very, very hard to find literature that supported this, especially for our U.S. physicians and people who work in emergency rooms, and for our patients with MELOS presenting to emergency rooms. We felt that we needed to have a stronger document out there in publication that would be used as a reference. So I'm going to go through the stroke protocol that we have now published, and that should be available for clinicians that are looking for it. And I believe there's also a link on our website to that article. The third thing I'm going to discuss is our next project, which is the creation of standards of care for mitochondrial disease patients. Right now, if you go to any center, they might do things a little bit differently. There really isn't an overall standard of care. We would like to develop these and publish these so that we start getting some more uniformity about care that patients are receiving. And the reason that this is important, and I'll show you this in some other slides, is that this really will help improve the overall morbidity and mortality for our patients, and also it will help us define what should be included in centers of excellence. And when I get to the centers of excellence project, that is really where I'm going to want to hear a lot of feedback from the community, and I'm going to outline our plan in terms of how are we going to develop mitochondrial centers of excellence. So on the next slide, and this is a big shot of the poster, and I'm going to hone in on different topics that are on this poster, but you can see that the titles Organ Transplantation and Mitochondrial Disease Proceed with Caution. And the reason we decided to add the proceed with caution is because there were many people in the transplant world that were thinking, don't proceed at all. And the proceed with caution is really geared towards liver transplantation in the PolG population, which has kind of been a well-known issue for at least the past decade. But this was really for the transplantation audience. And again, I've had patients that may have needed a transplant, and the transplant doctors thought, well, is this a contraindication, the fact that our patient has mitochondrial disease? So I'm going to walk through this poster with you. And so on the next slide, and again, I apologize for the fuzziness here, and I'm not going to read every line, but the introduction basically went over the fact that transplantation is happening in patients with mitochondrial disease. Right now in the literature, it is filled with documentation that patients with mitochondrial disease have poor outcomes. And this is only in limited case series or case reports. And what was unclear to us is whether the underlying disease had any impact on post-transplant course. So we wanted to collect cases of our patients that had been through a solid organ transplant and pool them together, and we decided to focus only on solid organ transplant of the heart, kidneys, or liver, and patients needed to have a confirmed genetic mitochondrial diagnosis. So on the next slide, this just reviews our methods, and I'll just point out that this was a total of 35 patients from 17 mitochondrial disease centers, including North America, the United Kingdom, and Australia. We had put out a query for people to respond to on the mito listserv and the metabolic listserv and the child neurology listserv, and we had, again, 17 different centers respond that they wanted to help contribute patients for this project. And we also wanted to try to statistically come up with a Kaplan-Meier curve of survival. And this is kind of a standard curve that's used in many different fields for overall survival. What we found in terms of patients needing transplant were that patients with the MELOS mutation 3243 were the group that most frequently needed a kidney transplant. The mitochondrial DNA depletion disorders were the group that most needed a liver transplant. No specific disease group were in most need for a heart transplant. And the need for a transplant did not seem to correlate with the severity of other organ involvement, and it was required across all age groups from birth to age 60. And I'll go over some of those particulars. We wanted to ask specifically the question if mitochondrial disease got worse after the transplant, because, of course, transplantation is an enormous surgery, and then there's certainly a lot of not only anesthetics being used in the postoperative course, but also immunosuppression. And what we found was 26 patients had immediate disease worsening. Over half of them had relatively minor issues, such as lactic acidosis, the onset of diabetes, or pseudo-obstruction. One MELOS patient did have a stroke-like episode after the transplant. And as is already known, PolG patients were the patients with the worst outcomes post-transplant. On the next slide, this is just an overview, mainly of North America, showing where in the country the patients were coming from. And again, it was a total of 35 patients over 17 centers, and included four countries. On the next slide, there's some colorful graphs, pie charts and graphs that really depict the diseases represented in the upper left-hand corner. You can see that 18 patients in yellow had mitochondrial DNA point mutations, 8 had known nuclear gene mutations, 12 had a mitochondrial depletion syndrome, and 2 patients had single deletions. Below that, and this is very interesting, disease recognition, 57% of patients had unrecognized mitochondrial disease at the time of their transplant, and 75% had other manifestations, including other organ involvement, which meant 25% had only single organ symptoms at the time. So that came down to 5 patients who had a single organ dysfunction. One was a Lee disease patient that had cardiomyopathy without yet brain involvement, and one patient had a mitochondrial DNA depletion disorder with only isolated liver disease. In the upper right, you can see the age and sex. The sexes were pretty matched. It was 18 females and 17 males, and again, the age range was 6 weeks to 55 years at the time of transplantation, but a mean age of 15 years at the time of transplant. And as far as rejection, this was not very common at all in our population, and so only 17% of our patients experienced some rejection, and they were all treatable. On the next slide, this shows our cohort versus overall survival of our patients. So you can see that in terms of liver, we had 85% survival. In the blue is our cohort, and then overall survival is in the purple, which is kind of the national standard. So our cohort, there was a 75% survival rate compared to greater than 85% for the general population. For kidney, which is in the middle, our cohort, there was a 100% survival compared to the national average, which is 85 to 90%. And after heart transplant, we had an 82% survival rate, and published survival for a heart transplant is 80 to 90%. In terms of postoperative complications, about 50% of our patients had more common transplant-related complications, and that included some medication side effects, electrolyte imbalances, vascular problems such as clot, infection, lymphoproliferative disease, which is something that can occur after transplant, kidney insufficiency, osteoporosis, and rejection. The next few slides go into detail about each organ transplant. And so the first one is the liver transplant patient summary. And again, we had 12 patients that underwent liver transplant. Just looking at the disease type, 12 of these patients had, all of them had mitochondrial depletion syndrome. Half of those were Polgy-related, and 5 of those had Alpers disease, which was probably not recognized at the time of the transplantation because this is now considered a contraindication to liver transplant if that child is identified as having Alpers syndrome. But Polgy can also present in an older age group and is not as devastating as Alpers, and that's what's meant by the ataxia next to that. So one of our patients had ataxia. The other nuclear mutations that we saw in this group include DGWK and MPV17, which are known to cause a mitochondrial depletion liver disease. And then in one patient, the nuclear mutation was not well identified. In terms of the etiology of liver failure, again, the Alpers patients, 5 of them were valproate-induced liver failure. This is a preventable cause of liver failure, and many centers now in the U.S. are now screening patients prior to putting them on Depakote for the Polgy mutations. In the other 7 patients, the liver failure was otherwise disease-related and was not triggered by the use of Depakote or valproic acid for seizures. And then we only had 3 patients that had some disease worsening, 6 that had some temporary post-op complications, and the survival was 9 with 3 deaths from this population. And then on the next slide, this is the kidney transplant summary. And again, I just want to focus on the mutations that we saw. Interestingly, when you look at the mitochondrial disease type, 9 of them had a mitochondrial DNA point mutation, 2 were MELAS, 3 were maternally inherited diabetes and deafness, and those are from the same mutation, so all 3243 patients. One of these patients had a mitochondrial DNA deletion, so Kearns-Sayre syndrome, and 2 of them had two patients, unrelated, had mutations in a gene called RMND1, and this is a known neurologic and renal syndrome, which is a nuclear gene, and there will be a publication about that gene specifically coming out of the UK, again, with many centers contributing patients to describing the RMND1 gene and what those patients look like and what the symptoms are. So in terms of, I'm just going to go to the next slide. So on the next slide, heart transplant, we had a total of 11 patients that had a heart transplant. Again, looking at the mitochondrial disease type, four of them had a mitochondrial DNA point mutation, which was either related to Lee syndrome, MELAS, or ND5, which is a complex 1 gene. One patient had Kearns-Sayre syndrome, and then six had another gene, another nuclear gene mutation. Two patients had a mutation in a gene called ELAC2. Two had a gene mutation in AGK. One had a mutation in AARS2. And then one was a novel mutation, which is currently in publication. Six of these patients had a hypertrophic heart, four had a dilated heart, and one had heart failure due to cardiac arrest. And again, the survival was nine patients survived, and two died post-transplant. So the next slide, in conclusion, we felt that our patients actually tolerated solid organ transplantation with survival approaching national averages, meaning that having mitochondrial disease should not be a contraindication for solid organ transplant, with the exception of Polgy-related mitochondrial disease. Mitochondrial patients certainly remain at risk for transplant-related worsening, and again, that's when we would recommend that fluids be given, and we follow, kind of an emergency protocol, having a genetics doctor actively involved to help support that patient through the postoperative course. Interestingly, over half of the patients received a transplant without the underlying diagnosis being known or being discovered after the transplantation. And again, this was especially true for the patients with Polgy-related disease, where liver failure was provoked by valproic acid. And again, we probably are not going to see that anymore because people have been very vigilant to test patients before giving them valproic acid. And in the case where this does happen and there's a valproic-induced hepatic disease, that patient it would not be eligible for a liver transplant. So again, I think overall this was very promising. We're telling the transplant community that there's only one exception, the Polgy patients, but otherwise transplantation was very well tolerated by our patients. There are some post-operative guidelines that need to be developed, and we have developed anesthesia and surgery guidelines for our patients, and so they need to be followed. Of course, the problem is if you go into that transplant not realizing that that patient has mitochondrial disease, then there can be complications. So hopefully people are being more thoroughly evaluated for the cause of their organ failure. So I'm going to switch to our next project. And of course, at the end of this, I'm happy to take any questions. But the next project was, as I mentioned already, really formalizing our stroke protocol guidelines so that there was a piece of literature that people could pull off the internet when a MELAS patient came into the emergency room having stroke-like events. And so this was, it's already been published online in JAMA Neurology, and I believe it's going to come out in print. I believe it's already in print as well, but this came out first online. So the next slide, again, is the abstract from this project. I'm not going to read it line by line, but we wanted to point out that we realized that MELAS patients have stroke-like episodes. There, we felt there's plenty of evidence at this point to use a nitric oxide precursor, arginine, to help with the treatment of the acute stroke. And even though there are still studies being done and still some questions about the dosing and the timing of arginine, we strongly recommend arginine is given urgently to a patient presenting with stroke-like episodes in the emergency room. And so the next slide is a very simplified stroke protocol. And again, there's more in the paper, but our current recommendations are to give IV arginine at a dose of 0.5 grams per kilogram per day for 3 to 5 days. And what we recommend is during the time that the patient still has the stroke-like symptoms, whether it be weakness on one side or loss of vision in one eye. And then we also recommend that MELAS patients are placed on oral arginine for stroke prophylaxis at a slightly lower dose of 0.3 grams per kilogram per day. And so right now, this is the current stroke protocol. We have, again, details of whether there should be a constant infusion or bolus dosing and other things to watch when that patient is admitted for the stroke-like episode. The next, I'm going to switch again to the next topic, which are the preventative care screening guidelines. And again, this is really our next big project that we want to tackle. We feel that there is a lack of standards of care for mitochondrial disease, and we also question when we have a patient in the office, how often should they be seen by audiology? How often should they go to the ophthalmologist? And some of this is going to be very disease-specific, but some of it should just be done globally for every mitochondrial disease patient. And I had to make a lot of edits to this slide, and I accidentally left in a couple names of the physicians who volunteered for this project, but I'm going to fill you in on the rest of the details of who's going to be participating and the extent of each subject area and what we're going to tackle. So this is, again, just started. We have, I believe it's over 30 doctors who are going to be participating in this project. We're now forming working groups, and the working groups are two or three people. We're going to review the known literature for that specific organ or system and create a summary. The Newcastle group in England already has online guidelines, and so we are going to rely on them and their previous work, and they've also agreed to help us with this project. We're going to create recommendations on lab work and testing that's needed and the time interval that that testing is recommended, and we will separate recommendations when there's high-risk disease. For instance, patients with Kearns-Sayre syndrome are at risk to develop an arrhythmia, so they may need very different guidelines than the general mitochondrial population. And then we're divided into working groups. Our timeline is to review these and then distribute the reviews to each other by late summer, do the editing, and then by next January prepare the manuscript and then hopefully have that in press by this time next year. So if I just go down this list, again, anesthesia guidelines, we already review this thoroughly using a similar system of working groups, and there's already recommendations published in our consensus statement, which was published in Genetics and Medicine last December. That document, for people who are not aware of it, is also posted on our website, and we went over consensus guidelines. So this is slightly different, creating preventative care guidelines. The consensus guidelines are what are mitochondrial doctors doing right now, and the preventative care screening again, is moving forward. How can we improve the care that all of our mitochondrial patients are receiving? So the next topic, number two, is audiology, and this will be done by Carolyn Sue in Australia and Dr. Bruce Cohen. We're going to cover sensorineural hearing loss and the use of cochlear implants. And again, we're going to have guidelines about how often do patients need to be screened and followed by formal audiology testing. Number three is cardiac, and this will be done by Drs. Haas and Brunel. We're going to separate this into cardiomyopathy, arrhythmias, pacemaker placement, especially for Pearson Kearns-Sayre patients, hypertension, and chest pain. Number four, critical illness. This will be done by Drs. Jaya Ganesh and Fernando Scaglia. The topics under critical illness will include endocrine worsening, especially adrenal insufficiency. So some guidelines about using cortisol, for instance, during a critical illness. Acid-base status, worsening renal tubular acidosis, arrhythmia in this setting, respiratory issues related to weakness, and then any other categories that we can come up with. And I just want to take a moment just to point out that the critical illness physicians are well aware of mitochondrial disease, and I feel that they're aware that anyone who's in an ICU is in an acute mitochondrial crisis. They follow lactates. They follow the trending lactates down because usually lactate is a good biomarker in the ICU, and so we're going to be touching base with ICU doctors to see what else can we include in that topic. Number five is endocrine, and this will be done by Drs. Shana McCormack, Annette Fiegenbaum, and Peter Stackpool. We're going to break this down into thyroid issues, parathyroid hormone issues, including abnormal calcium and vitamin D, adrenal issues, diabetes, short stature and growth hormone deficiency, and then bone density issues, especially as it relates to non-ambulatory patients and osteoporosis. Number six, GI, will be done by Drs. David Dimick, Rita Horvath, and Dr. Kaur, and we're going to cover liver disease, constipation, motility issues, nutrition, and failure to thrive. Number seven, hematologic issues, will be done by Drs. Marnie Falk and Michio Hirano, and we're going to cover anemia and bone marrow failure. Number eight, immunologic issues, will be done by Dr. John Christodoulou in Australia and Dr. Mary Kay Koenig. Number nine through 12 are all neuro topics, and we had to divide this into four sections. So the first section for number nine, neuro one, will be done by Drs. Sunito and Koga. Dr. Koga is the Japanese physician who first started using arginine for Milos stroke. So they will be discussing epilepsy, migraine, and movement disorder. Neuro 2, which will include Drs. Mark Tarnopolsky, Mancuso, and Salvarnova, will include myopathy, neuropathy, issues of tone, including spasticity and dystonia. Neuro 3 will be covered by Drs. Clara Van Carnebeek in Vancouver and Dr. Tyler Rimichel, and they will cover developmental delay and learning disabilities. And Neuro 4 is stroke, and again, we've just published those guidelines, so we will be referring to our published guidelines. Topic 13 is ophthalmologic, which will be done by Dr. Zuela and Kendall, and we will break this down into retinal and optic nerve disease, ptosis, and ophthalmoplegia. Number 14, orthopedic, will be done by Drs. John Schaffner and Mark Corson, and we'll really focus on scoliosis. 15 will be issues concerning pregnancy, and this will be done by Drs. Patrick Chinnery and Greisemer. There's no note about this yet, but I would think that we will be covering or at least mentioning the mitochondrial transfer therapy as one of those issues. But I think they also will be covering during pregnancy how that can create a metabolic stressor for a woman and any additional guidelines at that time. 16, psychiatric, will be covered by Drs. Richard Fry and Sumit Parikh, and we will talk about depression, anxiety, and personality disorder. It's not listed here. I'm going to add, and since Dr. Fry will be participating, I believe that autism or behavior problems will be included in that topic. I'm also hoping to get Dr. Fry to give us some guidelines about things like cerebral folate disorder, B12 deficiencies, and the therapies that he's working on at his institution. Number 17, pulmonology respiratory issues. That will be done by myself and Dr. Amel Kara in Boston. We'll be talking about central and obstructive apnea, respiratory insufficiency, and sleep-related issues. 18, renal acid base and electrolytes, will be done by Dr. Greg Enns and Shamima Rahman, and they will cover acidosis, renal tubular acidosis, and glomerulonephritis. Number 19, surgery precautions, again, are already published in our consensus statement, so we will not be developing new guidelines there. And then number 20, constitutional symptoms, will be done by Drs. Irina Anselm and Lynn Wolf. And this will include fatigue, pain, weight management, and high altitude travel. And I wanted to go through the complete list with everyone because I know there's many people on the call. And again, we developed this based on organ system and based on the issues that we felt were very pertinent to cover. And certainly after the guidelines are published or even as we're developing them, if anyone has a very strong suggestion for an addition or something is obviously missing, I would really appreciate that feedback. So again, hopefully these guidelines will be published within the next year. It's going to take a lot of work for our working groups, but this system worked very well when we developed our consensus statements that was published in December 2014, where we broke into working groups. Everyone did an excellent job reviewing the current literature, seeing what was already out there as far as publications, and then we even did some Delphi surveys among each other to really get down to the consensus statement, and we're going to do something similar here. Again, the idea moving forward is that people have a very good idea of when to have any of these organs either evaluated by that subspecialist or in the case of critical illness, pregnancy, surgery, we have some guidelines for our patients and other physicians to follow. So I'm hoping to get some questions about this or some comments about this after this talk. Okay, that leads me to the next set of slides, and I'm almost done with the slides, but I really also need everyone's help in terms of starting to formulate the centers of excellence. So currently, there is really no centers of excellence for mitochondrial disease. There are very well-known centers where patients go. I think that MitoAction has a published list of physicians that are recommended. UMDF has a published list. As I mentioned, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society has a map on our website with mitochondrial physicians. But terming something a center of excellence is a totally different proposition. And we feel that it's almost time to roll out centers of excellence. Mary Kay Koenig does run a mitochondrial center, which she calls a center of excellence, but that is not based on following any type of national guidelines. So again, I just finished talking about creating these prevention guidelines, and really there's no reason to have a center of excellence unless all the centers are doing something similar. And so it's very important for us that we first develop the guidelines. But at the same time, we're going to start figuring out how to create these centers of excellence. And this is something that we have decided, the Mitochondrial Medicine Society, this is important for us to do as a project, as the clinicians. And we're going to keep this separate from NAMDAC because NAMDAC, again, the North American Mitochondrial Disease Consortium, these are centers where mitochondrial patients can go. There are only 16 of them in the country, and right now it's really being used as the bioregistry and natural history studies, which is great, but I think we need certainly to name more than 16 centers of excellence for our patients to be to have a presence in the United States. So the first thing that we're going to do, and I'd like to have suggestions on this also, is we want to create some focus groups of patients, families, and caregivers to start talking to people about what they envision a center of excellence to look like. When you go to a mitochondrial center of excellence, what physicians do you expect to be there? What services do you expect to be there? Do you need other ancillary services such as child life, a social worker, a laboratory? You know, we want to hear about all the details that you expect to be in a center. And so this is kind of where we create a wish list. And we're hoping to do this live, either through phone calls such as this or at a patient family meeting. And then so from the input that we get from the support from these focus groups, we also want input from the support groups, from the Elhan Foundation, from MitoAction, from the UMDF. What have people who are working behind the scenes within the support group, what do they feel that the patients and families also need from a center of excellence? From all this information, we're going to create surveys so that we can reach even more people. And this will hopefully be done via email where we can have a bullet point list of here's what we think a mitochondrial center of excellence looks like. Please vote yes or no. Write in what else you would like, and that will be distributed on an even wider basis. So we will then distribute those surveys and collect data, and from that, we're going to formulate a checklist of what the Center of Excellence needs to have in order to serve our community. And so the Center of Excellence requirements will come from what the patients and families and caregivers need, input from the support groups, and, of course, input from the clinicians at each one of those centers. From this checklist of requirements, we will then develop a questionnaire that we will need to collect from a potential center of excellence. And there are very good examples of this already in process. I mentioned early in the call, I'm also the director here of the Neurofibromatosis Clinic. And, every year I have to fill out an annual report of how many patients I see, what services I have available at my center, and we continue to be named an affiliate clinic for the Children's Tumor Foundation. There are other great examples, such as the Tuberous Sclerosis Foundation, the Muscular Dystrophy Foundation, and the Cystic Fibrosis Foundation. And so we're collecting questionnaires right now from these other disease organizations to find out what else do we want on our questionnaire for each center of excellence. And then those questionnaires will go out, and we will be advertising for the fact that we're creating centers of excellence, and if people want to apply, to let us know, and then they will get a questionnaire, and then we will be forming a governing board to make sure that that center of excellence is following the published standards of care, which are, again, right now being created, and fulfilling the requirements. What still needs to be fleshed out is how are we going to do this? So, again, the NF for my NF clinic, I fill out an annual report that goes to main headquarters. They see that I filled out my report. I'm still fulfilling all the requirements, and my status continues as an affiliate clinic. Someone like the CF Foundation for Cystic Fibrosis, they actually have a group of doctors who make a site visit every 3 years to that particular center to make sure that the clinic space is adequate, to make sure that the hospital is providing funding for that clinic, to make sure that there aren't any ancillary services that are needed, to make sure that the lab is up to par. But the CF Foundation has a lot of money to do this, and they not only pay the doctors to go do site visits, but they also give funding to each one of those centers to maintain that center of excellence. So we're still talking actively with industry, with the support groups to try to figure out how much support is each center going to need, and how are we going to make sure that the centers of excellence can kind of meet that bar. Once we set that bar, we want to make sure that the centers are able to fulfill it. So on the next two slides, and this is, again, just an example that I found several years ago using cystic fibrosis as our example. And so on the next slide, I have survival in cystic fibrosis. This is still an incurable genetic disease. Complications are multisystemic, involve not only the lung for this disease, but GI, pancreas, kidney, bone, and certainly psychiatric. But if you look at their morbidity and mortality, life expectancy for CF has increased tenfold in the past 60 years. And so why? Why has that happened? How were they able to increase life expectancy tenfold without having a cure for this disease? And on the next slide, and I apologize for this being fuzzy, but I'm going to walk you through it. Everyone can see that red line that starts in 1930, where patients were surviving maybe a year if best. And then throughout, starting in 1950, pancreatic enzymes were given, then airway clearance, then certain antibiotics. And then I have a big red circle on something that you probably can't read, but what that says is patient registry was started. And so once the patient registry was started, things really started to improve because we then had better epidemiology. Who are the patients? Where do they live? What sex are they? What are they getting the antibiotics for prophylaxis? Are they getting airway clearance? Are they getting pancreatic enzymes? And then, of course, lung transplant came along starting in the 80s, 90s, and then some other treatments were also added. But the survivability has gone up to, it's now even past 40 years of age. People are now surviving CF. And one of the other things that this slide doesn't point out, along with the patient registry, was the development of the CF Foundation Centers of Excellence. And so what that means is that every center is doing the same thing. All of their patients get enzymes, all the patients are on active clearance, all the patients are getting antibiotics, there's an active lung transplantation program, and again, it's system-wide care, it's homogeneity as much as can be there for each one of these patients. And the table to the right, I'm sorry again for the blurriness, but they wanted to also point out that some of these treatments are simple, that's the first column, pre-existing, cheap, and one of them is non-pharmacologic. And again, we want to start thinking about any other treatments that, again, fill these criteria. What treatments are simple, cheap, pre-existing, and non-pharmacologic? And those are going to go into our prevention of care guidelines and our create our standards of care so that, as I said, each patient is hopefully receiving similar care, whether you're in Pittsburgh or California or Canada. And we'd like to create these standards so that we have, again, uniform care, but also I'd like to see a line that goes like this for our patients, especially for our smallest patients with Lee's disease, where some of them still have a survival rate that does not go past 5 years of age. So if we can improve this with creating standards of care and then creating our standards of excellence, then we and our centers of excellence, we've done a very good job in moving the field forward, even without having a new drug on the market or a long-term cure at this point in time. So that's the end of my slides. I want to thank everybody for listening. I hope I've given you some new information. And again, I'm very anxious to hear feedback about our prevention guidelines as well as the centers of excellence, because I think it's going to take the entire community to help chime in and help us figure out where do we go from here and directions moving forward.
Thank you so much, Amy, and for all of these updates. Really wonderful work that the Mitochondrial Medicine Society is doing. Truly very exciting. And I have some ideas on ways we could create a poll or a survey for people to be able to, you know, post comments and give feedback about these centers of excellence. So I'll circle up with you on that. And people who are listening, if you have ideas, feel free to email me, but do keep your eyes out for the next few days for something on our social media and through email asking you to provide feedback about those centers of excellence. And Dr. Goldstein, you and I can chat a little bit about that as well. I have a couple slides that have come, a couple questions, sorry, that have come in via email. Let me ask those first and then we'll open up for general questions, okay?
Sounds good.
Okay, so the first question was about hepatic insufficiency and if you knew anything about a methionine breath test. Apologize if I'm saying that incorrectly. If you have known any of that, because that was a test that was used to demonstrate if there was a problem related to, I guess, incompatibility of the liver being able to metabolize medicines for patients with mito or metabolic disorders. Do you know anything about that?
Can you repeat the beginning of the question? What type of test was?
A hepatic insufficiency test.
And what was the actual test called?
Methionine breath test.
So this is something I'm not familiar with. And I am not clear about a breath test for hepatic insufficiency. And something that I would have to look into a little bit. One, there is a test that a lot of patients have been asking me about. However, recently, I feel that more and more physicians are sending what we term pharmacogenetic testing, meaning does that patient have any difficulty breaking down certain medications? And it sounds like that was part of the question. So, for instance, there's a test to check on something called cytochrome P450 in the liver, and this is a very important enzyme that helps break down many medications in the liver that have to be cleared through the liver. But the breath test is something that I'm not familiar with, but I'm just wondering if it's something similar to that. And again, if patients with mitochondrial disease either are at risk to develop hepatic problems or already have some mild hepatitis or hepatopathy as indicated by some elevated liver enzymes, then making sure that drugs that could further harm the liver are modified significantly in terms of the doses or avoided altogether.
Great, thank you. And one other question from email, and then I'll open it up for folks to ask live as well. So this parent asks about her 5-year-old daughter who does not have a formal diagnosis of MELOS, but has had a stroke-like episode that appears to be in response to the flu vaccine last year. She actually had vomiting and hemiparesis, and her care providers aren't sure if this could be considered a stroke-like event without having an actual diagnosis of MELOS and without being able to see any stroke-like lesions on the MRI.
So this is a great question, and I think that it really demonstrates that we have to separate symptoms from any genetic confirmation, because I'm kind of reading between the lines, but my first reaction is just because you can't confirm this isn't me, that this is me loss doesn't mean that that patient experienced those symptoms. So the symptoms are the symptoms, and those symptoms need to be evaluated. And there are many times that someone might have stroke-like episode and have it not show up on an MRI. It's always confirmatory for physicians when you can see abnormalities on the MRI, but if nothing shows up, you know, that's what we call a TIA, right, a transient ischemic attack. And there are patients with MELOS and other mitochondrial disorders that can have stroke-like episodes. Sometimes it can even be more linked to a migraine, like a very complicated migraine. And so there were a couple other things that I just want to hit on because of the question. It was mentioned that there was a flu vaccine that may have triggered this side effect or symptom for this patient. And I will say that we always put out a statement about vaccines because this, again, this is one of those questions that comes up to us over and over again. Is my mitochondrial disease patient safe to get vaccines? And without a doubt, we are all recommending vaccinations. We're all recommending the flu vaccine because we have all seen patients of ours decline significantly when getting that live infection. I don't recommend that anyone get the live vaccine, however. So the live vaccine is the nasal. So I prefer that all my patients get the injection, which is not the live flu vaccine. However, having said that, we also are very much aware that any time a patient with mitochondrial disease has a fever or an infection, that can also create symptoms and problems. And so while we think that the vaccines are safe and should be utilized for our patients, it's also important to make sure that that patient is getting plenty of fluids around the time of a vaccine, and also if there is a fever or discomfort, to check with your provider and use Tylenol or ibuprofen. There are also physicians that have advocated for using something like Singulair at a time of a vaccination. So there are many different ways that we can kind of help temporize any side effects for that vaccine. And of course, there are patients, a handful of them, that perhaps had a very devastating reaction to a vaccine. I think those are few and far between, and it's a very individual decision at that point with your provider about whether it's safe to continue to get certain vaccines and then to think about separating them into single vaccines only. So in other words, instead of getting the full MMR, to separately get measles, mumps, rubella instead of the triple vaccine.
That brings up, just kind of going back to those standards of care, I think what you're saying is really important because right now that burden of communication is on the parent and the patient to convince their healthcare provider that that's the best approach to take when, you know, because we're hearing this as a community and we know from experience from people that we love that they may not do well with, you know, multiple vaccines stacked at one time, but it can be challenging without standards of care. So I think it really speaks to the importance of the work that you guys are doing to have that documentation that this is the kind of pragmatic approach, really, for patients with mito. Sorry to interrupt you, Dr.
No, absolutely. And I just wrote down on my paper to make sure that John Christodoulou and Mary Kay Koenig, when they do their immunology section, to put in something about vaccines. This is a very important topic.
And were you going to say anything else about that, Dr.
Well,
Goldstein?
I wanted to make sure that I fully answered the question that you had posed because there were so many topics kind of within that question.
And I think the only other piece that you hadn't really spoken to, and you did a little bit, but is, you know, maybe clarifying, when you say that someone has a stroke-like episode, I think classically in medicine you expect then to see evidence of that on an MRI or to say, well, we know that you have this genetic diagnosis of something like MELOS. But how would you feel about being able to then predict the probability of a patient having additional stroke-like episodes and prevention of that or concern and responsiveness to that if you don't have either of those things, meaning you don't have a clinically relevant, you know, significant MRI and you don't have a genetic diagnosis of something like MELOS?
Right. So I'm a neurologist, so it's actually easy for me to try to address this question. If I had a patient who came in with a stroke-like episode and there was no evidence for that stroke on MRI, I would still treat this, again, as a TIA, as a transient ischemic attack, which is, you know, what people also refer to as a mini stroke or stroke-like episode. I feel like these are all, you know, kind of very similar terms that we use. So that person deserves a full stroke evaluation. And a full stroke evaluation includes not only mitochondrial testing, which is often forgotten, actually, in the stroke workup, but an echocardiogram, testing for other clotting factors, testing cholesterol levels, testing lactate, testing homocysteine levels, and then looking at the family history for any other pertinent information, and then performing genetic testing when feasible, not just for the common 3243 MELAS mutation, but you know, full mitochondrial DNA sequencing, because there are other mitochondrial point mutations that can cause MELAS. And there are also some nuclear gene mutations that can mimic MELAS. Like, for instance, POLG classically can mimic MELAS. So I'm not sure the extent that that patient was worked up for stroke, but if any of these tests have not been done, again, you know, I don't stop with, well, we weren't able to confirm that you have MELAS, so, you know, we're not going to do any further testing. So hopefully that patient had a complete stroke workup. In terms of arginine, however, I think this is where it gets tricky, because right now when we formed those recent published guidelines for stroke prevention, it is specific to the 3243 MELAS patients. Now, I've spoken to my colleagues, and I also give arginine to other patients besides the 3243 MELAS patients. I have a patient with the 13513 MELAS that is on arginine, and I have a patient with POLG who has MELAS-like stroke-like episodes, and I have her on arginine. But those are off published guidelines. You know, so it's I would say it's off-label. But I think that several of us, and again, in talking to my other colleagues, several of us might use arginine in that situation to help prevent another episode. It's just very unclear what that patient's future risk factors are. And so I think this has to be discussed very carefully with the physician who's involved. And arginine itself does not have a lot of side effects. It can be difficult to give it, especially if you have to give it in powder versus capsule form. But I think that the side effects are few. The problem is we don't know if it's actually indicated.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Goldstein. Okay, I'm going to open up the lines for a couple additional questions. Just as a reminder, we'll take as many questions as we can, but don't panic if you don't get a chance to ask your question. You can email me, director@mitoaction.org, and I'll be glad to connect with Dr. Goldstein to ask your question. And we'll just take turns like it's a virtual classroom. And I will remind you that the call is being recorded, so keep your questions general without too many personal specifics, please.
The conference is now in talk mode.
Okay, so who would like to ask the first question?
I have a question about arginine levels.
Okay, go ahead.
So my son has really, really, really high levels of arginine naturally in his blood, and he's had many stroke-like episodes as well as actual strokes. Is there a correlation of he actually has the recessive marker for arginine deficiency, but it's not the full-blown two genes, so it's only just the recessive, and I think it's a biochemical reaction that his body has such a high level of arginine, and I'm just wondering, is there a correlation between excessive levels of arginine and stroke-like episodes?
That's an excellent question, and actually the opposite is true. So when we look at patients that have MELAS, we actually find lower arginine levels in their blood. And we think that that's one of the reasons that patients have stroke-like episodes for MELAS, because arginine is a precursor for something called nitric oxide, and nitric oxide helps dilate the blood vessels. So if you have lower levels, the idea is that those blood vessels are more shut down and are more at risk for causing ischemia or, you know, lack of blood flow to the brain. And so that's one of the ways that arginine helps, is because you're repleting a low level of arginine, and and helping, again, to create more nitric oxide. So high level, again, I'm not a biochemical geneticist. I've seen patients that have higher levels of arginine, and usually when we see either really high levels or really low levels of one of the amino acids and it's not connected to an inborn error of metabolism, it's typically dietary. So I'm not sure if that's possibly why your son has higher arginine levels.
He's G-tube fed on formula,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't really take anything else by mouth.
Mm-hmm. And again, you know, this is not based, this would be based on my hypothesis
yep.
and not anything that would be proven, but I feel that sometimes patients have an elevation in something as, you know, a feedback looped as, you know, to kind of be protective. So I don't know if somehow physiologically he's figured out he needs to have higher arginine levels and he's creating that. I don't think there's not a downside to having elevated arginine
okay.
in isolation.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Who would like to ask the next question?
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I'd like to ask, is it possible to print slide number 18, preventive care screening guidelines?
I believe that I can make sure that Christy has those available when we publish the full slide set on the website. I'm going to need to leave some of the slides out. The slides that contain unpublished data will need to be left out, but I'd like to make sure that you all have the list of what we're going to create to make sure that people can chime in or add to that if necessary.
Oh, thank you.
So, Dr. Goldstein, when you send me an updated version, for everyone who's listening, there'll be two ways you'll be able to see that. Perhaps, Dr. Goldstein, for the things that would be relevant for folks to be able to print, then we'll have a printable PDF linked on the page where you found the information for today, and then we'll have the SlideShare program as well, so you can kind of view it in a presentation format. But as a reminder, the slides that we reviewed today are going to come down after today's presentation, but not to worry, there'll be an updated version available pretty quickly.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple more minutes. Anybody else have another question? Okay, Dr. Goldstein, do you have anything else that you wanted to comment on or share with the patient community and the people who are listening?
Well, I just thank everybody for joining in. I hope that you enjoyed my presentation, and I was really happy to be able to give you these updates. And again, the MMS is working very hard to bring to the patient community what is needed. We see where many of these gaps are, and we would like your feedback to help us fill in the gaps that we may not be aware of.
So, Dr. Goldstein, say again the Mitochondrial Medicine Society email address. And because I think that it's really important if people have not yet printed and shared the consensus statement papers, those are there, and that would be really important for people to print and share.
Yes, thank you. So the website is www.mitosoc, so MITOSOC, that's an abbreviation for Mito Society, .org. And the papers and guidelines, there are links to all of our published work on the website, as well as many other resources, such as reasons for lactic acidosis. Lots of educational materials are on our website.
Wonderful. Well, everyone, thank you so much for participating today. Please join me in thanking Dr. Goldstein for giving her time and energy, not just for this presentation, but for helping to shape the field of mitochondrial medicine and strive towards better standards of care for all of us who have people in our lives or who are personally affected by mitochondrial disease. And Dr. Goldstein, thank you so much for that. And certainly, everyone, please keep your eyes and ears open for a call to action asking for your feedback about these centers of excellence. It sounds like an amazing initiative, and as you've heard me say before, we, the patient and parent community, are the pioneers and partners in this field of mitochondrial medicine. So our participation and our feedback and our voice is incredibly important because we are living examples of what works and what doesn't and how we shape the field of mitochondrial medicine. So your feedback is really, really important. Dr. Goldstein, I hope you have a wonderful weekend. Thank you, everyone. Happy spring. Join us again in May, but remember that the Fridays every week, same time, same telephone number as today, there's also a standing support group that you're welcome to participate. Great opportunity to ask more questions, meet other people with mitochondrial disease, share resources, and so forth. Everybody, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.